Greetings and salutations. Welcome to this episode of Playwright Spotlight. Before we begin, smash that like button, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment down below, and share this video with a friend. If you're listening to us on your favorite podcast platform, be sure to leave a five-star review and subscribe to the channel. My guest today is a writer, director, producer, actor, and teacher. His play, The Last Lifeboat, has had more than 50 productions in North America and has won over 60 regional awards. His recent play, Marilyn, Mom and Me, was the recipient of the Southwest Theater Production Sponsors Award, the Moondance Stage Play Award, and the Writer's Digest Award for Best Play, and is set to open this February 16th at International City Theater in Long Beach. His play, Confessions of a Star Maker, was recently a finalist for the Stagecraft Stage Play Competition and was chosen for the Last Frontier Theater Conference. Other plays include A Place at Forest Lawn, The Man Who Killed the Cure, and The Jesus Hickey. He has served on the advisory board of the William Innes Theater Festival for the past 20 years and recently completed his MFA in writing for the performing arts from University of California, Riverside. And he serves as the head of playwriting at California State University, Fullerton, where he teaches playwriting, theater criticism, and script analysis. His book, The Art of Writing for the Theater, An Introduction to Playwriting, Script Analysis, and Criticism, was published in 2022. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Luke Yankee.
Thank you. Thank you, James. Happy to be here.
It only took two or three times to do it. Three or four. Full disclosure, everybody, forgive me. I'm a little under the weather with a little head cold. And my glasses keep fogging up. So we're gonna ditch these. Luke, thanks for coming. We were gonna do this in person and this cold came on and you're starting rehearsals.
I am
for Marilyn, Mom and Me. So are you directing as well?
I am directing. I'm wearing both hats. So the plate is very full at the moment. I'm also starting classes at Fullerton this next week where I'm the head of playwriting. So I'm good at spinning plates.
No, absolutely. Yeah. We're in theater. We're supposed to, you know,
absolutely.
Unless we surround ourselves with the right people, which I'm sure you do.
Yes.
There's a lot I want to get into with you with your biography and whatnot, but let's go into this. Is this the first production of Marilyn, Mom and Me?
Yes. Yes, okay. It is. The world premiere. And I'm incredibly excited about it.
Wonderful.
My mother was the actress Eileen Heckert, who won an Academy Award for the film Butterflies Are Free and is in the Theater Hall of Fame. And she played Marilyn Monroe's best friend in the film, The Bus Stop. And one of the things, James, my mother was kind of known for playing these hard boiled, tough characters. And to the day she died, she couldn't talk about Marilyn Monroe without bursting into tears. Mm. And no one else had that impact on her. And I knew there was something really deep in her connection with Marilyn. And I had heard the stories over the years about their relationship and, you know, what the various stories about shooting Bus Stop and things that happened on the set and all of that. But I started really digging in and really doing some research to fill in the gaps. And I found some fascinating things. First of all, when Marilyn shot Bus Stop, she was the biggest star in the world. And she had taken the year off the year before to study at the Actors Studio with Lee Strasberg in New York. And she had become the poster child for method acting, where one has to feel everything organically. And since my mother was playing her best friend, Marilyn was determined to make my mother her best friend. And at first, my mother was like, okay, who's this starlet who's glomming onto me and making me feel very uncomfortable? But the two of them really wound up forming this incredible bond. And I like to say, I feel that they bonded through their wounds because both of them were adopted. And because of that, for all that they achieved, neither one of them ever truly felt that they deserved a place at the table. And so while, you know, there was a great deal that happened on the set of Bus Stop, as, you know, many ups and downs, and I relate those in the play. But my mother's relationship with Marilyn ultimately wound up impacting me, even though I wasn't even born yet at the time. Yeah. So what I mean by that is that it was a complicated relationship, as many, you know, parent-child relationships are. So the play goes back and forth between 1956 on the set of Bus Stop and in 1999 when a 40-something Luke learns that his mother is terminal with lung cancer. Mm. And he's trying to get some answers about their relationship by unraveling her very complex friendship with Marilyn Monroe. So it is a deeply personal play. As you mentioned earlier, it's already won some major playwriting awards, including the Stanley Award, which is, they give one of those a year, and it's a rather prestigious playwriting award. And some of the past recipients include Terrence McNally for his first play, and also Jonathan Larson for a little play called Rent. So so I'm in some really good company, and really, really thrilled to be having the world premiere at International City Theatre in February. We go into rehearsals on Tuesday, and I've got an amazing cast, an extraordinary team of designers, and a lot of interest from Broadway. And some major New York producers are flying in to see it. So I could
congratulations.
Not more, thank you. I could not be more thrilled.
Because this is such a personal play, is that the reason you decided to direct it as well?
Yes. Yes, really. My background is primarily as a director. I was a Hal Prince protege. I've directed over 40 productions. And I find I often like to direct the first production of my play because I kind of want to protect it. But particularly in this case, since it is such a deeply personal story, and I mean, there are moments in rehearsals where I'll suddenly go, oh, God, I really went there, didn't I? I mean, I'm incredibly exposed and incredibly vulnerable in this play. And so, yeah, all the more reason that that I wanted to really do the first one myself.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because when I got the notice that you were going to rehearsals, I'm like, okay, here's a playwright who's going to be so immersed in it, not realizing that you were directing. And that's why I wanted to ask, because, you know, there's many other questions I would have asked had you not been directing, but were planning on being there. So, because usually I'm of the ilk that, and I don't doubt your directing experience or talent, but I always have been in the ilk. It's like playwrights shouldn't direct their work. That's me. I'm old school in that regard because I think a fresh set of eyes always brings something more that most playwrights wouldn't realize that, oh my God, I didn't even see that, you know, because when we write, we get in that flow state and, you know, people ask, like, where did that come from? What does it mean? Like, I don't know what it means because I wasn't thinking. I was just like, this is what I spewed onto the page. And so sometimes there's certain things that are missed when somebody else picks up the work.
Anyways, well, I absolutely see your point, James, and a lot of people feel that way. But considering the fact that I have been directing for 40 years and really started out as a director long before I became a playwright. And again, you know, given the personal nature of this play, I'd be reticent to give it up to someone else.
Sure, 100%. I don't blame you. And that's why, I mean, it's a very, very personal story, obviously. And so, I mean, that's, not that I'm the arbiter of who should be directing their own work or anything like that, but I would be protective of something like that as well.
Well, you know? And I mean, I really kind of go there in a lot of ways. I mean, in addition to the very personal stories about Marilyn and her relationship with my mother, for instance, I also tell the story, while there are many very funny moments in it, there are a lot of heartfelt moments where I tell the story of saying goodbye to my mother for the last time when she was dying of lung cancer. And so, you know, every time in rehearsal, we're reenacting that scene and I'm rehearsing that scene. It's needless to say, there's a bit of a lump in the throat.
Oh, sure. 100%. I'm sure there's going to be some personal struggles, just kind of revisiting all those moments and taking a different perspective. You know, now you're, you know, instead of being taking a third person perspective, I suppose you could say, because you're not going to be. Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Well, congrats on the Stanley. I do want to talk about that. What's that process? How does that come about?
You know, I submitted it, was told that I was a finalist, and then was told that I was the grand prize winner. And it's sponsored by Wagner College in Staten Island. And they flew me out and did a reading of the play with the students. And I was part of a Q&A. And, you know, it's funny because that was when I heard about that, I was just finishing up my book, The Art of Writing for the Theater, that came out last year, which includes, I'm sure we'll probably talk more about that, but it includes interviews with 16 playwrights and librettists and critics, et cetera. So I was in touch with a couple of them about, you know, final details, et cetera. And one of the people I was in touch with at that moment was Stephen Schwartz. and who was just about to start work on the film of Wicked. And I said, "Dear Stephen, you know, if you could just sign this form, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and by the way, just as a fellow scribe, I wanted to let you know that I won the Stanley Award." And he was like, "Holy shit, Luke, you won the Stanley. I didn't win the Stanley Award. I submitted for it when I was a younger. I didn't win." I thought, wow, I am in good company.
That's wonderful. What? How does that submission process go?
You know, one of my favorite tools, and I wonder if any of your other writers have talked about this, is Play Submissions Helper.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful subscription-based piece of software where, and I think it's something like $7 a month or $9 a month.
It's very, very reasonable.
Very reasonable. And it you get a monthly listing once you're a member of everything from how to submit to the Pulitzer Prize to how to submit for the 10-minute play competition in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, you know, to everything in between. And I've won some terrific awards and gotten some great exposure for some of my plays through that. And that was how the Stanley Award came about. It's like, wow. Oh, this looks interesting. So there you go.
Was there anything on their end that they required, you know, or was it just like, okay, here, pay your submission fee, send us your play. We'll talk to you in a few months.
I'm sure they asked me some questions about the actual process and that sort of thing. And of course, with all of those competitions, they always want to make sure that it really is your work and all of that. But no, I mean, basically, it was just like, hi, you're the winner.
Sure. Well, that's awesome. Yeah, question on that. I would imagine it is. It still is and will be for quite a while. Just because the nature of what we do in theater, as far as structure and everything goes, sometimes we, and it's required only to tell the story because, you know, the way that the act structures work and the way that, you know, you got to, you know, the inciting incident and then, you know, that climax. Is there anything, especially in film and television, but is there anything that you had to embellish or take creative license with in this particular play, considering it's based on actual people and true events? Or was everything in this play true to form? There's nothing that was made up to help the story along?
Yeah, actually, James, everything is pretty much true to form. And pretty much as it was. And, you know, the dramatic license is very minimal in this play. Sure. I try to write tend to write historical pieces for the most part. And with some of those, I've taken more creative license than I do in this one.
Sure.
But one of the interesting things about that is I had a reading in New York at Manhattan Theater Club. And a very prominent producer said, there's a famous photo of Marilyn with my brother, who was 2 years old, in her arms. And this prominent producer said, you know, Luke, I really think you'd get a lot more mileage out of it if you made that you. So I thought about it, and I actually tried it for a while in one or two drafts. And some dear friends who've been with me throughout the whole process said, you know, Luke, if you take that kind of a liberty right at the beginning of the play, people are going to question the veracity of everything else in the play.
Mm.
And so I went, you know, they're absolutely right. So I created a device where the Luke character, still sounds odd to say that, but it's a 40-something me, where the Luke character basically wishes so desperately that he was the boy in that photograph. So I address it that way, and it becomes kind of a plot point. But sometimes people are disappointed. It's like, you know, it's like I've told them there's no Santa Claus. It's like, what? That's not you in Marilyn's arms? But, you know, if anyone does the math, they're going to realize that I wasn't born in 1956.
Right.
So I feel really good about that decision and about the fact that I maintained the integrity of that and found a way to make it work within the play.
Sure. Good. So going through your experience, what got you into playwriting?
Like everyone else in this business, you kind of need to learn how to pivot. And I started out as an actor. I was in all of the theatrical unions by the time I was 15. I studied at Juilliard. And then in my mid-20s, I was kind of in between types and the work started to dry up. Mm. So I thought, okay, let's try my hand at directing. So at first I started directing things in church basements, community theaters, wherever they would have me at first. To get my feet wet. And while I was doing that, because of my professional contacts and family contacts, I was assistant directing on Broadway. So I assisted Hal Prince, Ellis Rabb, Gerald Friedman. I mean, some legendary theater directors, Brian Murray. And so then, you know, I went down the directing path for a while, ran two regional theaters, and then things... I went through a dry spell in that regard. So I turned to playwriting so that I would have something to direct.
Mm.
and in the more I got into it and the more I really sharpened those tools, obviously the better I became. And so when I really, really got into the playwriting, I really felt like I was wearing the shoes that fit me the best. So now, while I still occasionally act and still produce and that sort of thing, it primarily I go back and forth between the directing and the playwriting, and of course the teaching.
Is there any one of those roles, if you will, that helped you in playwriting more than the other? Was it the director role, the acting role? What aspect or position in theater, if you will, helped you out with your playwriting the most? If you could say one, maybe it's every single one of them.
That's a really good question, James. I think probably the director, because obviously as a director, you're looking at the whole picture. And, you know, one, and also probably the producer as well, because I know that for the most part, you know, thinking about what audience you're writing for.
Right.
I mean, for instance, my play, The Last Lifeboat, has a cast of, it's a flexible cast starting with 13 and kind of going up from there.
Wow.
I'm not going to get professional productions of that because the cast is too big.
Sure.
I mean, maybe down the line, who knows, but I know that it's problematic in that regard. So most of my plays, Marilyn Monroe and Me, is a cast of five. Which is obviously much more producible. But I think being able to see things from the director's perspective of looking at the whole enchilada has really helped me make me a better playwright. And of course, all my years as an actor and understanding character and all of that and dialogue, it's hard to pick one, but they all are part of the package.
Would you ever tell anybody who's considering playwriting, like, hey, look, good for you. I think that's a great idea. Go direct, get some directing under your belt first. Do you think it would be more beneficial or?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I certainly encourage my students to do that. My playwriting students. And a lot of times they're sort of directing readings of their own work in my classes and to be able to convey what they want that is on the page and to just start to develop that vocabulary, because obviously it's important.
I'm going to wind up having to come back to this because I'm
sure
there's a lot to unpack.
Sure.
When you started playwriting, had you taken any workshops, any classes, or are you just like, I'm gonna give myself a chance at this?
I really hadn't. Obviously, I've subsequently taken a number of them, but one thing I did do that actually I take that back, because I was on the advisory board of the William Inge Theater Festival for about 20 years, and where every year out in Inge's hometown, this little tiny town of Independence, Kansas, not to be confused with Independence, Missouri, which is a booming metropolis compared to Independence, Kansas. I mean, it's like the town in the Last Picture Show. I mean, this little tiny kind of Dust Bowl town, but they would honor a world-class playwright every year. So I got to be part of tributes to A.R. Gurney and Stephen Sondheim and Marcia Norman and David Henry Hwang and incredible people. And I think that really was what sort of first sparked me to start into playwriting, was hearing these people talk about their careers and doing workshops with some of them. And it was really, the Inge Festival was an incredible thing.
Who inspired you the most, or who did you learn the most from, if you can remember? Or was there a spark that they gave you and said, that's it, I'm done, I'm going to do this?
Well, actually, one of the ones that I kind of related to the most, and with my book, The Art of Writing for the Theater, I contacted a bunch of those people and interviewed a bunch of them. And so, because the book is a how-to book on playwriting, script analysis, and theater criticism. So in addition to the how-to parts that I wrote, I have, as I mentioned earlier, I have interviews with, you know, world-class, Tony-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning, in some cases Oscar-winning playwrights, lyricists, critics, people like Ben Brantley, and I just an extraordinary list of people. So every one of those hour-long interviews I did for the book was a masterclass for me. And I think one of the things, and I must say, even though some of these people were people I had met before, I got terribly nervous before I did these Zoom interviews. And, you know, thank God during COVID, I mean, a lot of people were available. And I just, some of these people that I didn't know and just reached out to out of the blue, they were like, hey, all of my commissions have dried up for the moment. Sure, I'll talk about the craft for an hour with you. What the hell? So, but Donald Margulies, I think, was the one where I realized that we kind of have a similar writing style. And the fact that I realized that I have a similar writing style to a Pulitzer Prize winner was very exciting.
Sure. What is your style?
And this is something that Donald sort of echoed, and that so basically, I write the scene I have to write first. It's just like, I mean, so it's like, okay, I'm passionate about this scene. I know this scene. Maybe it's in the middle of the play. Maybe it's in the beginning of the play. Maybe it's towards the end. But it's just like, okay, I know this scene has to happen. So then I'll write that scene. And then, okay, and then I know this scene has to happen at another point in the play. And then I sort of stitch them together. I don't necessarily recommend that writing style, because sometimes you can paint yourself into a corner and it's like, oh shit, how do I get from here to here?
Right. You know?
But I write a lot from my passion, and it's like, okay, if I'm passionate about this scene, I'll find a way to get from point A to point B. And that's, like I said, it's, and some people are strict with outlines and all of that. But Donald Margulies has a similar approach. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for him, I'm not going to, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Were there any other styles as you were going through this, working with all these playwrights, are there any other styles that really stood out to you that said, I like that? I can't do it that way just because the way my brain works. But I you know, maybe you tried it and it's just like, okay, I can't do it. But, you know.
Well, one of the things that David Henry Hwang talked about was he talked about when he was studying with he had done a workshop early on in his career with Maria Irene Fornes. And he talked about how they would have people write to different pieces of music. And it was just sort of, you know, free playwriting based on, you know, jazz or acid rock or whatever, and change the piece of music every few minutes. So I try that exercise with my students, and I've even tried it for myself, and they find it very distracting. And I did too, because it's like they would just start to get in a flow with a piece of Dave Brubeck or something. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, it's Gershwin and or something totally different, and the flow goes away, you know? And so, but I must say, of all the playwriting stories I heard for the book, James, and there were incredible ones, my favorite one, and this has become somewhat of an iconic playwriting story, maybe you've heard it before, it's about David Henry Hwang, when he had his first interview with Joe Papp. And this was when Joe Papp was the god of Off-Broadway and Broadway and doing Chorus Line and so many amazing shows. And so David Henry Hwang had written and saying, you know, there's no, there really are no Asian American playwrights being represented and this needs to change. And so Joe Papp was like, okay, put your money where your mouth is and send me a script. Mm-hmm. So David Henry Hwang sent him a script. They did a reading of it. And Joe Papp said, yes, it's an interesting play. Meet me in my office on Tuesday and I'll give you some notes on the script. So Tuesday came and David Henry Hwang is sitting there with his pad and judiciously taking down everything Joe Papp is saying to him. And Joe Papp said at the end of the meeting, okay, so you go away and make those changes and then maybe we'll consider producing it. So David Henry Hwang got home and he looked at the notes and he went, I don't agree with a one of these. So he waited a couple of weeks, sent the exact same script to Joe Papp, hadn't altered a comma. And Joe Papp contacted him a few weeks later and said, oh, it's so much better. We'll produce it now. And I said to David, I said, what gave you the guts as a, you know, 25 or something, 24, 25 year old playwright? What gave you the guts to do that? And he said the play had had a reading at the O'Neill Theater Conference prior to that, to his meeting with Joe Papp. And he got a lot of notes at the O'Neill and he incorporated them and he thought it made the play worse. So, so he wasn't going to make that mistake again. And so, I mean, the rest is history. David Henry Hwang, who went on to win the Tony and the Pulitzer. And I mean, he's just, I'm not sure that he did win the Pulitzer, but he definitely won the Tony, as needless to say, is one of our national treasures as a playwright.
Is the thing to take away from this then that you just make the changes that you agree with and, you know, take these and throw all the others away? Because, I mean, you know, there's got to be some good key moments in there that might be good pieces of advice. And I don't want anybody to walk away as like, oh, well, the takeaway from this is like, never listen to anybody. And you know better, you know? Yeah,
absolutely. I agree with you. And that is a dangerous takeaway. And no, I don't think that should be the takeaway, but by the same token, it's your play and 100%. Only you can, you know, only you are the arbiter of what goes in it or what doesn't. But by the same token, my mother used to talk about, she did a Broadway play called by Robert Anderson called You Know I Can't Hear You When the Water's Running. And it was directed by the great Alan Schneider, and who directed so many Beckett plays originally and so many Albee plays, things like A Delicate Balance, etc. And he was a wonderful director. And long after the show had opened, he would come back and give copious notes. I mean, he would send, you know, like 15 pages of typed notes well into the run. And so Marty Balsam, who was the lead in the play, would just throw them away. George Grizzard would pretty much throw them away. My mother would read them because for every four crappy ones, the fifth one might be absolutely brilliant. And she wouldn't have gotten that experience if she hadn't read them. And one of the stories that I share about that, which I think is a terrific story about him, and I always use this as a director, is that one night he said, Alan Schneider hadn't directed a lot of comedies at this point. And there was a note one night that said, darling, I'll bet you $5 that if you punch this line twice as hard, you will double the laugh. And Mom thought, I know comedy, and it's been getting a nice laugh, and I really think he's wrong about this, but he's the director, I'll try it. So the next night, she punched the line twice as hard, and this line that had been getting a really great laugh, nothing. Absolutely nothing. So the next time Alan gave notes, his notes started with, darling, I owe you $5. So as a director, I always tell that story when we get, you know, into final run-throughs, et cetera. And I said, okay, now this might be an I owe you $5 kind of note, but I want you to try it.
Fair enough. How many of your plays have you directed for the first run? Because you said you like to do the first one. Mm-hmm. How many are under your belt?
Let's see. I co-directed a couple of them. My husband, Don Hill, is a wonderful director. He was a protege of John Houseman at USC, and he is the chair of drama at UC Irvine. And so he and I have co-directed a couple of productions at UC Irvine. My first play, one of my first plays, The Last Lifeboat, which has had close to 70 productions around the country by the end of this year. Awesome. And then I think most of them I have directed the first reading. As I said, at least to sort of protect it and hear it. And then for the most part, once I've kind of heard it, then I can turn it over to someone else, as long as they're open to me being in rehearsals and all of that, sure. They usually are. But yeah, I've pretty much done the first reading myself.
So two questions on that. Mm-hmm. Have you gone through doing that? Have you gone through and made changes?
Constantly.
Okay. And it's constantly. Totally changed, you know. And that's, I'm going to guess that's pre-publishing.
Yes.
Unless you've had something that was published and then like, oh man, I got to fix that.
As a matter of fact, with The Last Lifeboat, after it was published, and I was thrilled the fact that it got published quite early on. So it got published and then I had a few more productions and went, oh, I need to do a reprint. So I contacted the good folks at Dramatis Play Service and I said, so I'm assuming in this digital age, this shouldn't be too difficult. And they said, actually, Luke, and this was probably about 10 years ago at this point. They said, actually, we still typeset. So if you want to do a reprint, we'll have to destroy all the old copies, et cetera. And it's going to cost you, I think it was somewhere around $2,000.
Wow.
And I decided it was worth it to me to do that, to have the version out there that I wanted out there.
Fair enough. All right. Now, as you're directing, how collaborative, when you go in, because you just said, I want to go in, I want to be part of the rehearsal process.
Yeah.
How much leeway do you give the actors and the director as far as, you know, how collaborative are you? Are you like pretty stringent?
No, I like to think I'm very collaborative. In fact, the actors on Marilyn, Mom and Me have been with the project, the three leads in particular, have been with the project for 4 years now. And so, you know, it's not at all uncommon for them to say, hey, Luke, you cut this line and I really think we need to put it back in because it adds this and this and this. It's like, okay, great. Let's put it back in, or let's at least try putting it back in. So, I like to think I'm very collaborative.
Okay.
And having been an actor for so long, I mean, there's that old cliche about, how playwrights and directors should all study improv, because rather than saying no, but you learned how to say yes. And
yeah. Now, I've been on a few, improv teams where it was a lot of no, but drove me nuts.
Of course.
So you went in and you decided to get an MFA in playwriting.
Yes.
What, and I'm going to, because of your teaching aspect, I'm not doing that I won't be asking those questions from a confrontational way. This is a ongoing subject that's come up throughout past episodes. And I was really excited. I was going through your biography. I'm like, okay, good. Maybe we can finally put a nail in this. But what did you take away from going through an MFA program, first of all? Let me ask you that first.
So the reason I went back and got an MFA is that I was really tired of being turned down for teaching jobs for which I was highly qualified because of not having the piece of paper. And this was even to guest direct, you know, after running two regional theaters and assistant directing 6 Broadway plays, I couldn't even direct at most MFA programs, most colleges without the MFA. So I said, this is really pissing me off.
Sure.
So I didn't feel I needed to get an MFA in acting or directing. And since playwriting was kind of the newest hat, I found this incredible online program through UC Riverside Palm Desert, and it's a low residency program.
Okay, right.
And because of its access to LA, and because a lot of people, you know, want to stay at this nice resort in Palm Springs for 10 days where the classes were held. You would get Pulitzer Prize winning authors and amazing screenwriters and showrunners, et cetera. And I actually, at the time, the program didn't offer an MFA in playwriting. So it's actually what they call in writing for the performing arts. So it's screenwriting and playwriting, basically. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And I got so much out of it. I mean, one of my mentors, a wonderful producer and screenwriter named Joshua Malkin, understands story better than anyone I've ever met. And my playwriting instructor, Mickey Birnbaum, he was just incredible. I mean, I got so much out of the program. And I don't regret for a second going back for the MFA. And, you know, all of these places that, again, wouldn't hire me to direct, that there was one college in particular where they had said, well, do you have your degree yet? We're looking for a director for blood. And it's like, no, not yet, but I'm almost, no, sorry, call us back when you have your degree. So a month after I graduated, I called them and said, listen, I heard through the grapevine that you're looking for a director for Hairspray in the spring, and I just finished my, you're hired.
Wow.
So I have not stopped working since I got the MFA. It's made a tremendous difference in my life. And I've been, you know, again, now being the head of playwriting at Cal State Fullerton. I've had the MFA for 7 years now, and I've been teaching, well, for 8 years, and I've been teaching for seven of those years.
That, because that piece of paper makes so much difference.
It really does.
Sarcasm in that, because to me it sounds a little, I mean, I don't know, maybe you did walk away with a ton more of knowledge based on that, but it just seems like, I don't know, I just imagine somebody like this is probably going to be a bad example. Well, here, let's do this. Let's just say somebody like Lin-Manuel, because I don't know his academic experiences, and he walks in into some college and he wants to direct, and like, yeah, but do you have an MFA?
You know what? There are certain places where that would be the case.
And that's pathetic, because I don't know.
Well, and part of it has to do with the fact, James, that those programs get a lot of state funding. And, you know, there are bean counters who say, you know, we don't care who you are as long as you have an MFA. And that was why I just, you know, and I actually had kind of a snooty attitude about it for a long time. And I was like, well, with my background and Juilliard and having worked on Broadway and all of that, no, it didn't make a difference. I had to have the piece of paper. And I learned a great deal. And more than anything, though, it gave me, just doing that much writing in a grad program gave me a tremendous amount of confidence. And it gave me much more faith in my skills as a playwright and as a screenwriter.
Okay. And that's the other thing, because you said they'll give it to anybody who has a piece of paper, and I'm like, that doesn't sound good. Because you could have somebody who has no experience, who has an MFA.
I've seen it happen.
And, you know, they mean be the absolute worst person that you could have just hired, opposed to, you know, I don't know. So that aside, because we'll get back into that in a second. Outside of the piece of paper and the more confidence, what did you take away from those classes? What is there anything that you I'm like, oh my God, I've been doing this for so long, and here's something that I just never would have known or picked up had I not done this program.
Sure. So one of the things that they had in this particular program was you had your main genre and what they called your cross genre. So in more basic terms, your major and your minor. Okay.
Sure.
So a number of people would minor, a number of screenwriters in particular would major in screenwriting, and then their minor or their cross genre, as it was called in this program, would be something like either short story writing or poetry. And I was fascinated by that. And specifically with poetry, the people I know who did that, it helped with screenwriting. It helped their action lines and their log lines and their synopses. Because with poetry, it's about the exact right word.
Right.
And so, you know, it never would have occurred to me that, I mean, their log lines and their action lines in their screenplays after that were so spot on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I did short story writing. And again, just learning how to write with that kind of economy really informed my playwriting. And so just again, you know, it's kind of like you were asking me earlier about the directing helping my playwriting or the acting or whatever. It just, that was one of the other things I got out of this program. And just, you know, being also in that company of really brilliant writers. And not only, you know, I wouldn't sleep when I was at, because it would, they would have these 10-day residencies. It was online except for these 10-day residencies at Rancho Las Palmas in Palm Desert, Rancho Mirage, rather, where, and so I love to say, you know, it was graduate school with turn down service and a spa and mints on the pillow. I mean, if you're going to go back to grad school at my age.
Well, I'll be honest with you, and maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a bitterness that comes from me that I just haven't come to terms with. I don't know. When I was kind of in that place in my life, I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing with my life? Where am I going? You know, the phone's not ringing. I've been in the industry for, you know, 20 years now. And sure. So maybe I'll look and go teach. And I applied at UC Davis for their MFA in directing. Didn't get in. And then I'm like, okay, well, been writing for a while. What about, and I went through, I had applied for UC Riverside as well, but not for the low residency, for the mm-hmm. actual, like, and it just seems for both of those, it's like, there's only so many classes that they offer within that realm, within that domain. So it's like, well, you know, you've got to take 56 credits to, you know, units to get your MFA, but we really only offer 26.
Well, the thing I loved about the low residency program at UC Riverside is that you can kind of tailor make your own program.
Right.
I mean, it was not uncommon for me to go to one of my mentors and say, this is what I need help with. This is what I want to work on. Great. Let's tailor a program. You know, for your next project, we're going to do something to help you with that. So it's, again, and going back to grad school is not for everybody. But for me, it had always felt like the missing piece.
Sure.
And just something in my head, you know, the fact that I did not have that MFA, and it was really one of the smartest decisions I've ever made.
No, I, you know, and that, because one of the, you know, after we got past this part, and my next thing was going to be make a case for academia. But I have to say you for the most part already have.
Yeah.
I can get behind pretty much everything that you've laid out in that regard.
Well, and the other thing, it's like, I've been teaching so much, it's a little all consuming and sure. It doesn't necessarily leave me the kind of time for writing that I would like to have. By the same token, it's cliche, but by your pupils, you'll be taught, you know.
Yeah.
I definitely learn things from my students every day. And a really great example of that is that I'll assign certain plays of mine for projects, et cetera. So for this end of the year project, one of the things I like to talk about when I start off teaching the Greeks and script analysis and all of that, I talk about the concept of deus ex machina, which for those of you who of your listeners who don't know what that is, basically it's at the end of the play when, you know, it seems there's no way this can be resolved. A sort of godlike figure comes down and says, okay, you do this, you do this, you do this, and everything will be fine. So it's a device that, and it was used a great deal in the Greeks and by Shakespeare, and it's still used in contemporary plays where like the policeman or the detective or something will come in. So I'm doing my play about the aftermath of the Titanic, the last lifeboat, and one of my students, and basically it's about J. Bruce Ismay, who is the owner of the White Star Line, and the incredible guilt and the intense survivor's guilt he felt. And at the end of this play, the character comes in, this young girl who is now a very successful doctor, and she says to him when J. Bruce Ismay is an old man, Mr. Ismay, you know, you saved my life on the Titanic that night when I was a little girl, and that's why I became a doctor, and you're a great man, and I owe my life to you. And he bursts into tears, and then shortly thereafter, he dies, because now he can die with a clear conscience. So one of my students said, Luke, I think it's terrific the way you put a deus ex machina into the last lifeboat. I said, I did? I had no idea that I had done that. So long-winded answer to your question, but I learned so much from my students. And I see some great examples of playwriting and you know, other aspects. And you know, there are certain times when I'm grading papers and I feel like I deserve hazard pay. But you know, that comes with the territory. So
expand on that.
At the risk of sounding like an old curmudgeon, a lot of college students do not know how to put a sentence together. There are a lot who are terrific, but a lot who don't. I mean, in terms of subject, verb, you know, just comma placement, sure, et cetera. I mean, it's just, it's kind of frightening sometimes.
And the reason why I was kind of like, well, you know, the interesting thing about that, though, because I think about this all the time, you know, going back to just high school, yeah, and how we're taught about, you know, run on sentences, or, you know, you don't start with an and, or, you know, make sure you don't, all these rules. Mm-hmm. But yet when you get into playwriting, as far as like dialogue or even like, you know, stage directions, even,
yeah,
you're not writing in complete sentences.
That's true. By the same token, one thing that I always say to my students, especially with playwriting, there was a student I had at Chapman a couple of years ago, and she's like, oh, I just saw that. And she was taking the advanced class without having taken the beginner's class. I was giving her a special exception, okay, et cetera. And so mistake number one. So she had seen this play in London that she absolutely loved that defied all structure. And she's like, I want to write that kind of a play. And I said, well, you need to know the rules before you can break the rules. And so she was like, yes, but. So I worked with her and kind of let her go further with it than I should have. And it was kind of a big hot mess that didn't make any sense. So, you know, point being, I mean, I am teaching a lot of the foundations, sure, because I feel, whether it's playwriting or script analysis or criticism or whatever, because I feel like, you know, and even with playwriting, sure. I mean, you know, a lot of times playwrights don't write in complete sentences, but you have to know the rules before you can break
them. Sure. How do the other two elements that you're in your book, the script analysis and the criticism, how does that help the aspect of playwriting?
I think script analysis, first of all, helps it a great deal, because you know, what's a protagonist? What's an antagonist? What's a climax? What's a denouement? I mean, I feel like you have to understand all of that to be a successful playwright.
Okay.
And in terms of the criticism, it's really, you know, And this is something that in one of the other interviews, who was it who said this to me? It might have been David Lindsay Abaire. Yes, it was, who has for many years has been the replaced Marsha Norman as one of the heads of playwriting at Juilliard before he went on to win the Tony for Kimberly Akimbo and all of that. And just such a lovely man and such a brilliant writer. But he was saying that, you read 10 plays and then you figure out which two or three you really like and why, and which ones you really don't like and why, in terms of learning your style, in terms of learning your sensibility, in terms of learning what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And so, so with criticism, it's just like, I say this early on in the class, I say, whether or not you liked it is irrelevant. Did it serve what the playwright was intending? Were the director's intentions clear, et cetera? So that may seem a little contradictory to what I just said, but again, you know, it's like learning how to develop your own style, and you need to read and watch a lot of plays in order to do that.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny, and I've mentioned this, and forgive me for beating this dead horse and from past episodes, where it's just like, I would never, and it was mostly for screenwriting than it was for playwriting. But I think the playwriting aspect is when I finally learned about the screenwriting aspect. Cause when I first moved down here and I had first started writing, people were like, oh, just read screenplays. You'll learn. And I'm like, okay. And I probably every couple months I'd go to Barnes and Noble and buy, you know, four or five and bring them home and read them. And I'm like, okay. I did not learn a thing.
Now, I'm curious, James, were there some where you just went, oh my God, this was amazing? I mean, the one that everybody talked about in terms of a television script when I was in grad school, and I did a lot of these Screen Actors Guild, Writers Guild seminars with great playwrights, screenwriters and television writers and all. I mean, everybody talked about how brilliantly written the pilot for Breaking Bad was. Mm. And that was the pilot where every producer in town at that moment was like, oh my God, you've got to read this pilot. It's amazing. So I guess my question for you is, were there any scripts for you that were just like, wow, that was really well written. That was really satisfying. I learned something.
I didn't learn a thing. Hmm. And I'll tell you why in a moment, because it wasn't till I started guest directing and being part of the reading committee at Harvard Westlake, their student written one act festival. And it wasn't until I started sitting down and reading, and there are some brilliant, brilliant writers at Harvard Westlake. Don't get me wrong when I say this, but at the same time, it wasn't until I started reading the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Until I started realizing what made the good stuff good.
Yeah.
Now I can start to recognize why this works and what stands out and why, mm-hmm. but it didn't click until that moment, you know? And I think that's kind of where it is. It's like, you know, it's like, oh gosh, I don't know. I know better than that.
Yeah.
You know, I know the bad, I can recognize the bad stuff. I cannot yet recognize the good stuff.
Okay.
And what makes things, what at that point, what made something brilliant, because I didn't have that. Maybe I didn't have that exposure.
Right.
You know, and maybe that's where, you know, it's like, there's a difference. I got a bachelor's degree from California State University, Sacramento. And I think that's the difference, is because it's a general degree. It's not very specific. So you're not, you know, you're not really getting the nuts and bolts or like the really in-depth training that you would be if you were in a BFA or an MFA.
Well, and in terms of that, in terms of training, I mean, one of the things that I used to say when I would start, when I started out acting, long before I got to Juilliard and all of that, I would say, I got some of my best acting lessons in my parents' living room. Mm. Because, you know, my mother would critique me on every crappy thing I did in the basement of the YMCA in children's theater. I remember Paul Newman giving me acting lessons in my parents' living room of how to upstage my co-star in children's theater. I loved him for that. So Jan Miner, who was Madge the manicurist for Palmolive dishwashing liquid, who did those commercials. She did those commercials. Exactly. But she did those commercials in all languages all over the world. Mm. And they would break them down for her phonetically. So the point being, she was brilliant at dialects. So so anytime it's like, hey, Jan, I'm you know, playing this Russian soldier and I need a Russian dialect. And she's like, sure, darling, I'll come over on Tuesday. So I just had this. I mean, I'm well aware of the fact that I was given these incredible gifts as a very young person. And part of the reason that teaching means so much to me is that I felt a tremendous responsibility to give back.
Sure.
And so that's what I'm doing now. And I also feel I do that when I'm directing. To some extent, I'm doing that as a playwright, but certainly as a teacher. And, you know, I also teach musical theater technique, which is basically acting a song and making all the strong acting choices and all of that. So, so, you know, again, whenever I do that, I just feel like I'm giving back and I can hear my mother's words ringing in my ears, or Paul Newman or Jan Miner or whoever it is, you know, because I was given these incredible opportunities because of my upbringing.
Well, way to give back with all that knowledge. I mean, that's really commendable.
Thank you.
And I mean, that's seriously, I mean, you've been given some wonderful nuggets.
You know, one thing, James, that's really important for me to share, just while we're on the subject of teaching and all of that, and I would imagine other writers you've had on here have said something similar, but one of the things that I've learned, probably the most important thing I've learned, the thing I always teach my playwriting students is, in your writing, the more personal you make it, the more universal it becomes. Mm. Because, case in point, when I was writing my memoir, Just Outside the Spotlight, I would sit, my husband would find me sitting at the computer sobbing in the morning sometimes. And I'd be like, nobody's going to give a shit about this. And it's such a personal story. And it's going to sell 4 copies. But then when it came out, people would say, wow, your relationship with your mother was just like my relationship with my Uncle George or my father-in-law or, you know, whomever, or wow, I had a mentor or a teacher that, you know, was mirrored that relationship. Because the point being that, and again, in Marilyn Mom and Me, as I said, it is so deeply personal, but those emotions, those really basic emotions of, well, that my mother experienced with Marilyn, of just wanting to be loved, wanting to be accepted, wanting to be nurtured and cared for, and wanting to kind of be the best that one can possibly be. Those are things that we all feel. So if one writes from that very personal place, it will resonate with other people. There's just, I have no doubts about that anymore.
This is such a total tangent.
No problem.
It's such a great heartwarming aspect. So when it comes to going back to your book, when it comes to writing for the theater, an introduction to playwriting, what are the things that you cover within the introduction?
In terms, you know, I talk about a lot of the basics in terms of, because first it starts off with script analysis. And so, again, as I said before, understanding all of those basics of the climax, the protagonist, the antagonist, etc. But then I talk a lot about relationships and action and how all plays are a series of actions. And in the wonderful book, Backwards and Forwards, the author talks about, you know, it's like a series of dominoes. First this happens, then this happens, then this happens. So, again, you know, it's just covering and the whole thing in terms of dialogue. I mean, there's that old cliche that they say in acting classes about go watch people in parks, go to airports, you know. And I think one of the things that my work as an actor and as a dialect coach, which is another hat I wear. I've been dialect coach on about 40 different productions. You know, you get into speech patterns and rhythms, and so that your characters don't all sound the same. So that they have, and one of the things I talk about is I give the example of A Streetcar Named Desire. I mean, the way Blanche DuBois talks in these long syllables and with this flowery language, and it's very musical and poetic. And then you've got Stanley Kowalski, who talks in grunts and, you know, one syllable words, etc. And so I talk about the fact that if it's a well-written play, you should be able to cover over the part in the script where with the character names, and you should still know who's talking. So that they all have a unique speech pattern and a unique way of speaking, and just a really specific cadence to their dialogue.
Is there an exercise that's in there, or that you assign to your students on how to achieve that?
Again, I think I talk to them a lot about listening to other people. You know, hanging out in the cafeteria, or as I said, parks before. People used to say, and when I was studying acting, that they used to say one of the best places to observe human nature is in airports, because you know you've either got these tearful goodbyes or these joyous greetings. Oh, darling, it's so wonderful to see you again, and big warm hugs and all of that. Obviously, that's not as easy these days.
Exactly.
But there are still places where one can do that, you know? I talk a lot about human nature and just being a student of human nature and how that's what one needs to be a good playwright.
I don't refute that, but how does that translate onto the page? How do you put that on the page? I can go and watch everybody, but I don't necessarily know how to express that when I'm writing.
Sure. Again, you know, just listening to the way people talk, writing as freely as you can, for with someone's speech patterns and that sort of thing. Reading it out loud is huge. I mean, that's something that I'm sure a lot of your writers have talked about. Just, you know, and putting on the actor's hat, whether you're an actor or not, and just, you know, walking around your living room and reading your script out loud and talking like this character and that character, and really, you know, acting it out for your dog or your cat.
will you do that before you actually have a table read, or not even a table read, a stage reading, when I don't even sing, just, or even inviting people over, like, look, we're going to do a reading of my play. Will you read it out loud yourself before you invite those people over, or do you even take that approach? Or is like, I'm done, here we go.
I definitely take that approach. But for me, having had so many years as an actor, I kind of do that as I'm going along.
Sure.
And one of the things I say in terms of stage readings, and you know, people are saying, how can I hear my play? How can I get it produced, etc.? One of the things that I say in the book, and I, when I do seminars and that sort of thing, is I say, never underestimate the value of free pizza. So it's like, hi, I'm going to have a reading of my play on Tuesday night. I'd love for you to read this role. There'll be free pizza. So generally I'll have, you know, the actors and then I'll have a couple of people just there to hear it.
Sure.
And one of the things when I was doing the interviews, you know, Beth Henley said that when she would do those kind of readings, she did not want feedback. It's just like, thank you, I've heard it, you know, thank you for coming. Take a piece of pizza on your way out and good night. But most, and the way I would do them is that I want to hear the feedback. And yet sometimes when I would do that outside of a living room situation, say like I go to the next step after that and I rent a theater and I've got 100 people in the audience or 75 or whatever. When I do that, I've learned the hard way to do surveys rather than to get feedback, because sometimes you get really stupid feedback.
And I want to hear the stupidest, but I want to keep going with this because I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by the survey thing.
I have questions as the writer that I need answered. So, I'll find a way to phrase that question. And, I'll start off with things like, did the characters seem believable to you? Was there any moment that impacted you the most about this play? And is there anything that any moment that took you out of it, et cetera? But I really tailor the questions very specifically, because sometimes, sitting through the dumb comments can be really challenging. And yes, absolutely, there's something to be learned from everyone and everything. But, after doing it for a while, it's like I said, Beth Henley, for her, it's just like she found that was not helpful. By hearing it in front of an audience and like, oh, I didn't know there was a laugh there or whatever, that she heard what she needed to hear. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes she would call people privately the next day, but she never did the, opening the room to feedback kind of thing. And again, it's a very individual thing.
So is this a survey, like a sheet of paper that you pass around? Like, okay, I'm going to pass this around, fill it out, and then take the free pizza, take a slice of pizza on your way out, and we'll see you the next time around.
Well, actually, the pizza would be a separate thing. That would be like a reception afterwards, if that were. So it would be like the survey. And actually, a friend of mine who's a filmmaker, John Bennett, who's a dear friend of mine, who was used to be the chair of drama at Chapman, and he still teaches there. He spent many years working on a film. And he just did a very powerful film about letters from POWs. Mm. And he did a digital survey. It's like, okay, here he put the QR code on the screen and, click this on your phone and take the survey on your phone. And then he had them all electronically. A couple of years ago when I did it the old-fashioned way, on Amazon, I bought 100 of those little golf pencils in a box. And as everyone walked in with their program, they were handed, here's your program, here's your survey, and here's your golf pencil.
So you went all out. This is outside of the inviting people into the living room and just sitting around listening.
That was after the living room. I would definitely do the living room once or twice first. Yeah, definitely.
What is there a stupid comment? I hate phrasing it that way. Is there a stupid comment that just has stood out to you? And just like it, here's my stupid comment story that I've never been able to forget because it was so terrible.
Oh boy. I think we all have a lot of those.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was somebody and actually this person was a friend. And it was a period piece set in the 1950s. And this person came to her, and bless her, she's someone who's very supportive of my work. But she's things like, she would say things in her comments like, well, you had a line about saran wrap. Saran wrap didn't exist in the 1950s. Well, yes, actually, I did my research and saran. So it's you talked about that brand of chewing gum. Well, that brand of chewing gum wasn't around in the 1950s. I wanted to say, darling, you weren't around in the 1950s. So how do you know?
Wow. That commentary is not productive. There's nothing helpful about that.
Well, there was a famous book, and I think there have been other ones as well, but there was a famous book, I believe it came out in the late 60s or early 70s, and it was all of the really stupid memos that television executives had sent to writers. And the title of the book was A Martian Wouldn't Say That. And it was from the TV series My Favorite Martian. So the studio executive is like, no, he can't say that. A Martian wouldn't say that. It's like, oh, really? You know how Martians talk? Exactly. Well, please enlighten me. I mean, there are so many. There was one back when the Tracy Ullman show was very popular. And, she did a lot of sketches on that show as well. And she's in a story meeting and one of the studio execs is saying to her, well, I just don't think that line works. I mean, that's not Tracy's style. And she's like, excuse me, I'm Tracy.
Right. There's that famous scene in Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield is when he has Kurt Vonnegut Jr. write the essay on Kurt Vonnegut Jr. And he calls him up. He's like, you tell Kurt Vonnegut Jr. He doesn't know anything about Kurt Vonnegut Jr. But
there was some story about, gosh, I'm not certain who the actress was. I think it might have been Dolly Parton. And she was on vacation someplace and there was some small town and they were having a Dolly Parton lookalike contest. And so she used a fake name and she entered and she came in fourth. It might not have been Dolly Parton, but it was Jane Fonda. It was someone of that ilk, someone very recognizable.
That's classic. Since we're on those stories, before we get into my other question for you, because you worked with Paul Newman or you knew him.
Knew him.
I don't know how true story this is, but it's one of my favorites. So my former acting instructor, there was a professional acting class that we used to have over at Harvard Westlake, and Ted Walsh, who was actually some distant cousin to William Inge.
Mm.
But I guess Ted and Paul Newman were really good friends. And I guess there was some premiere or it was a night at the Oscars, and Ted and Paul's mom were in the limo together to this event. And she leaned over and looked at Ted and said, do you ever think that my son will be successful or will make it or something to that extent? And he had already had guess because that was probably the industry just was still not looked at something, you know, you want your child to be a doctor or a lawyer. Absolutely. Or something like that. And then at that time it was probably still frowned upon.
Yeah. Well, there's so many stories like that.
Yeah. But you mentioned that you go through the classics. Mm-hmm. What besides the and forgive me because I can never pronounce the
Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are there other things to be learned from the Greek tragedies?
Oh, I think there's a great deal to be learned from them. I always start with Oedipus when I'm teaching, and that is teaching script analysis. But I think the primal nature of those plays, because once you get past the kind of flowery language, I was actually in the American premiere of The Greeks up at the Williamstown Theater Festival. That was back when it was run by Nikos Sakharopoulos, this crazy Greek man who had taught at Yale, and he was a wonderful, wonderful director. But so he's talking about the primal nature of that, and it was a scene between, and basically it was a cycle of 10 Greek plays done over two evenings. Mm-hmm. And so it's really the sort of the cliff notes of these great Greek plays. But it was a scene between Clytemnestra, you know, regal Clytemnestra, and her daughter Electra, who was played by Roberta Maxwell and Jane White. I mean, two powerhouse actresses. And Nikos, in his intense way, we had this very nasal voice and this Greek accent. And so the two of them were being kind of regal and kind of a little aloof in this particular run through. And he says to them afterwards, he said, yeah, no, Jane, it's very good. It's okay. But you know, it needs to be more like, hey, Electra, give me a break. So, but again, you know, he's talking about, you get beyond the flowery speech and these primal, you know, it's life or death. It's just like, you know, he did me wrong, so I'm going to kill him. Right. And I obviously we don't all write plays like that, but I think getting at those sort of really basic emotions, I think one can learn a lot from studying the Greek tragedies. And I just love them myself. I know I'm a bit of a nerd and a geek in that regard, but you know, I've directed enough of them that I think there's a lot to be learned from them.
All right. And I'm assuming you go through all the different styles and genres and classics. I'm sure you make your way through the Greeks, through Shakespeare, through.
I don't have time to go through all of them. Mm-hmm. But I mean, because it's very much an overview. So kind of picking and choosing and, you know, representational of.
Well, I'm sure that you choose based on the, what you feel is going to be the most beneficial. So within that, within the realm of playwriting, who do you teach? What, who do you think that you, that are the most beneficial that you think that your students should, you know, sit back and this is, we're going to go through these because I think that they're going to, you're going to learn so much about this, the craft. By reading them.
It's interesting, James, because it's changed over the years and in only the 7 years that, that I have done it. And this is opening a whole other can of worms, but, with all of the political correctness now, suffice it to say, it's very difficult to teach something like Tennessee Williams right now. I think Tennessee Williams is brilliant, but several of my students complained when I taught A Streetcar Named Desire because of the misogyny, because of the violence towards women, et cetera. And I get that. I honor that. I respect that. And yet... you know, if we're not teaching the greats, it's there's an issue there as well. So long-winded way of saying that I now teach things that I feel are very empowering to today's students. I teach A Doll's House Part 2. And I also talk about A Doll's House, of course, when I teach that, because you have to understand the original. One of my favorite plays to teach and something that the students really relate to is, and I love saying the title, is Stephen Adley Gurgis's The Motherfucker with the Hat. And because, you know, so I'll start with Oedipus and then I'll end with that because, again, it's very primal in a different way. I mean, you're dealing with drug addicts in Spanish Harlem and these intense relationships and you know, a guy cheating on his girlfriend and all of that. And so it's something that is very relatable to them. And I've even found there are times I'll even connect them. I'll say, okay, so remember what we talked about at the beginning of the term in Oedipus? Can you see how some of these same things relate in Motherfucker with the Hat? I mean, oh my God, they do. So that's another aspect.
Can they not take that step back and not realize that this is just the sign of the times? This is how things were back in the day. And that there's still some benefit to reading this and there's still some, you know, or you just avoid that because you'd rather, it's just better not to have to deal with the pushback and the, I don't even know the right word for it.
To be fair, some of them really can see the value and they see, okay, that's the way it was in the 1950s. Some cannot. And so it's kind of stirring the hornet's nest.
Sure. No, 100%. But I mean, if you even, and not to push on this, I'm not, and you probably already know the answers to these things, but there's so much to be, you know, first of all, the progress of where we're at now, number one, if you take even Blanche's speech about finding her ex-husband or fiance with the, and how shameful and shunned that was. And coming from a place of Tennessee Williams and knowing his background, like, look what he had to, he was dealing with something similar, but he's not coming from a place that's offensive to me. I'm going to tackle it instead. I'm going to make it a piece of art and make a statement about it instead.
Well, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. But going off on a little bit of a tangent, that's kind of what I've tried to do with Marilyn Mom and Me. I've taken my very complex relationship with my mother, a lot of personal pain, and have put it into a play in order to help me as a person come to terms with it and to ultimately forgive my mother, which I think this is something this play has helped me to do, because while she could be terrific, she had her issues, as we all do. And so I feel like it's by putting it out there and really exploring this in the way that Tennessee Williams explored, you know, some of the abuse that he had in his past and that sort of thing. And because in many ways, you know, Tennessee Williams is Blanche DuBois. I mean, I think that's pretty evident. That I find that that's something we do as writers to express the human condition and to quote Shakespeare, to hold a mirror up to nature.
What do you think the most important element of playwriting is before we wrap this up?
I feel like I've already said it pretty much, but again, it's tapping into universal emotions through being very personal, through tapping into one's pain, one's joy, whatever you're looking at in that particular scene or in that particular play, to put it out there for others to relate to and or to not relate to, you know, as the case may be. I think one of the without getting too heady here at the end, one of the other things I talk about is the whole nature, getting back to the Greeks, the whole nature of catharsis and, you know, that purging of emotions. And there are two different ways to look at catharsis. I mean, one is the sense where it's very objective and you're feeling the pain and just like, oh, that reminds me of when something like that happened to me. And it's just, I'm so heartsick over that. And I'm, you know, feeling this pain and remembering this. Or there's the other kind where one is objectively looking at it from outside going, I'm never going to let that happen to me. And I think that's something we all do as writers. You know, it's like the audience is either feeling it with us or they're looking at it from the outside and either way going on the journey with us.
You know, you say that and I'm listening and it's just been a reoccurring theme in so many episodes recently about the catharsis, the cathartic aspect of playwriting.
Yeah.
And I'm beginning to wonder if that's really what playwriting is in its own way. It's like, there's an injustice going on, for an example, whether that's a social thing that I'm unhappy with and I need to find a way to deal with it, or there's a personal emotional thing that's going on with me that I have to find a way to deal with it, or there's this personal relationship that took a sour turn or a loss or something like that, and I have to find a way to deal with it. So I'm wondering if there's always going to be an aspect of catharsis in no matter what the play is.
I think pretty much so. I mean, one could argue but even in some of the comedies, I'm thinking of some certain, you know, kind of farces or like Noises Off or Lend Me a Tenor or something like that, you know, or the classic Feydeau farces and all that. But even there, I mean, there is a lesson and there is, you know, people are learning from them and people are expressing the human condition. So, I think that's what the best writers do. I mean, they are teaching by example, you know, and showing people, expressing the human condition. And I feel like that's our job as playwrights and as screenwriters as well. Writers of all sorts, really.
Where can people find your work?
Probably the best way is through my website, lukeyankee.com. And I also have websites for each of my individual plays you'll be led to from there. And Marilyn Mom and Me will be done at International City Theater. We start previews on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2024, and in a few weeks. And it runs until March the 3rd.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And are you on the socials?
I am indeed. I'm big on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, Instagram. And I'm a bit of a social media ho.
what's your handle on Instagram?
I believe it's Luke B. Yankee, and or it might be Luke Yankee _. I'm pretty sure it's Luke B. Yankee, and same on Twitter.
Wonderful, Luke Yankee, thanks for coming on this episode of Playwright Spotlight.
Thank you, James. It's been really exciting and stimulating.
Thank you so much. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Playwright Spotlight. Again, smash that like button, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment down below, and share this video with a friend. If you're listening to us on your favorite podcast platform, be sure to leave a 5-star review and subscribe to the channel. And in the meantime, and until we see each other again, keep writing.